Today is June 1st, 2016, and this is episode number 362 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, procurer of wine-like juices. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on the question, anything about the show, shoot us a note at macobserver.com. I can't keep a straight face. ACM@macobserver.com. That other voice you're hearing is John Keat, the devil's advocate, who is joining us.
Hi, fellas. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here.
I'm having a good time already. I don't know what, but I'm having a good time. Well,
it's probably because you're hungry, you know, like a wolf.
Like a wolf, yeah. Yeah. All right, before we fall down a really deep, dark, and troublesome rabbit hole, we have John on the show. John wrote a piece for us today. Okay, sausage making. He actually wrote it last night, and then we published it for this morning, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, way to take the mystery out of this.
I am mostly pedantic. Mostly. So, anyway, he wrote a piece for us about a way that Apple could maintain our privacy while learning about us. Mm-hmm. And this is a piece that I was really hoping that John would write. And I briefly entertained the idea of getting into it and then quickly realized that I had no business whatsoever talking about the subject. And John, you were honestly leery at first, but you did. You came up with a way to write about it, and it was a really, really good piece.
Yes, it was.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, you know, it really was, Jeff, your article on, I'm forgetting the name of the company that Apple acquired.
Vocal IQ.
Vocal IQ, and your early article, Brian, that kind of inspired me, where you both of you had somewhat of a common theme in saying, you know, I love all those new services like Amazon's Echo coming out, and it would be great if you guys had an option from Apple, because you actually would trust Apple to have to maintain privacy. But whereas all the others, you kind of trust that they will do anything but maintain your privacy. And also a general kind of theme of Apple falling behind on Siri not using more of your private information.
Let me back up a little bit on that, John. So the thesis that we've been operating under is the idea that because places like Amazon and potentially Facebook and Google in particular have their entire business model predicated on slurping up everything that they can about us, everywhere that they can, and knowing about us and knowing what we do and knowing which actions lead to which actions, knowing which search terms for Amazon in particular, knowing which search terms result in which results that result in which clicks we do, that all of these things allow the company to offer a better AI than Apple, which refuses to engage in those activities.
Right. And this is a great, I think, example of people just getting used to correlation and attributing it to causality, right? We're just so used to people keeping all of our stuff and providing us with great search services that we assume that privacy is absolutely necessary as consideration for getting these cool services. And in some cases it is, and in a lot of cases it's not. But continuing on with this to assume that you need it for artificial intelligence is probably at least not correct in a large number of circumstances. Let me, I guess, simplify that mess, which is to say, it ain't necessarily so that you need to give up your privacy to have an artificial intelligence agent that really knows you well. And that's kind of the overall thesis of the article. And it gets into, you know, some details about why and how you can still have your privacy, even though the artificial intelligence agent or, you know, like when I talk about artificial intelligence agents, I mean like Siri and Cortana and Echo and things like that. These little computer AIs that talk back to us, they can know a heck of a lot about us and have no actually tangible information about us. Much like I may know about, I may know about Brian's skeletons in his closet, but I might not actually possess the evidence to prove it. Right. So knowing something doesn't require it to have all kinds of private information that are somehow actionable and usable against you, which is always the worry with regard to our civil liberties and having warrants presented and things of that nature where information needs to be given over.
Well, it's not just warrants. It's hackers and criminal organizations and terrorists actually trying to get that information used against you too.
Mm-hmm. You are totally right. And the bottom line is that there's this corpus of information, and you know, with the break into some of the celebrity accounts on iCloud, there were photos. With regard to many of the cyber attack break-ins from the mob or just hackers, there are credit card numbers, there's transactions that you had on say Amazon or something like that. There's always actual pieces of data that are left behind that someone can look at and basically experience them because they're evidence. They are a corpus of information that's actionable, usable, perceivable. And that doesn't have to be the case with artificial intelligence. It just works differently.
But I have a quibble for you. So you say that. And by the way, this is the Apple context machine, so we should actually go into the particulars about about these two methods that you suggest Apple could, the two potential methods that Apple could use to do this sort of thing. But before we get there, if you say that having the end result of that studying wouldn't necessarily be actionable, to use your example, for instance, you know that my deep dark secret is that I like photographs with puppies wearing hats.
Oh man! Oh my! Oh my. Oh oh
oh! That's my deep dark secret. Actually,
Brian, John, I had no idea
you were coming out on the show, man.
John posted that in the article and a link to it, and I clicked through and just died laughing. I mean, it's like, first of all, there's a site dedicated to puppies wearing hats. Anyway, so you have learned that I like photographs of puppies wearing hats, but you have forgotten why you know that. You simply know that you know that. Again, you point out that the kind of the human brain kind of works that way too. But what if liking puppy photographs of puppies wearing hats becomes illegal? That could still actually be actionable. And it seems, as a matter of fact, that if I was a clever legislator or if I was a clever prosecuting attorney, that I would find a way to turn the fact that a suspect's AI knows that this person likes photographs of puppies wearing hats, that could actually in and of itself become an actionable piece of evidence.
So, you know, who knows what could happen in the future with regard to, you know, all the weirdness that government officials will try. But in essence, what you'd be talking about is doing an interrogation of an artificial intelligence agent, which is so nonsensical because that's not the way it works. It's not like you could ask Siri and say, Siri, tell me what I like, right? Apple would have to program in that ability for it to basically kind of articulate what is in its neural net. And that's a really difficult thing to do. It's not a terribly necessary thing to do because kind of you know what you like already without, you know, Siri telling you to do it. So the ways that Siri would act on them are triggers. I gave a good example. If Siri learns that you like puppies wearing hats, funny hats.
Legal puppies wearing hats.
Right. We want to make sure that that's clear.
There is a link to the site, by the way, in John's. I want to stress this. If you also would like to view photographs of puppies wearing hats, There is a link in John's article, and the link to John's article is in the show notes.
Thank you, Jeff. That's right. The Brian. legal puppies wearing hats, and the puppies are all of legal age, and they
no, they're not. They're by definition, they're less than you. Anyway, go ahead.
They're wearing hats, they're fine. So the point there is that how is it actionable from the way that Apple would run it? Well, one way would be when you get home on your Apple TV, you say, "Hey, tell me what's good on television today, Siri," and it notes that, "Hey, there was a new video that came on. It happens to be a video of dogs wearing hats," and it may recommend that to you. But it's not. But there's no evidentiary basis for that. Meaning, the neural nets that kind of said that this is a pattern that might be useful for you, one, are often really wrong, right? Just because you happen to have watch some shows. Sometimes I watch shows because I hate the people on it and I enjoy yelling at the screen and getting more recommendations of something similar is a mistake.
No. Really?
I hate that puppy's hat.
That you would do that.
And yeah, I actually do, sadly. Also, it just makes a mistake in assumptions, because there just needs to be. It's not infallible like a human brain. So there's nothing that says we're giving you this result of this video because there's evidence that you did something. It's kind of like any human being that observes something out in the street. You know, someone walked by and you got an impression of that person in some way that they like wearing hats because they happen to be wearing a hat that day, but in reality they lost a bet and they were forced to wear a hat that they hate. There's no, from a legal standpoint, there's nothing actionable on there, and there's no there for hackers to get a hold of. It is only a reaction. It becomes a reflex when a query is given to the AI when it's looking for things, it may prioritize those videos to come up, but it's not because there's a receipt that shows you bought 15 videos of puppies wearing hats before. It's just a general impression that the AI has developed. And similarly, just if we ask you or we ask Jeff about your puppy hat wearing video proclivities, he may know it now, and he may say, yeah, that you may like that, but there's no actual evidence of that.
Yeah, but I've watched Star Trek, man. Eventually, Siri's going to be on the witness stand.
Well, you know, that
it's true. Eventually, AIs are going to be artificial intelligence, virtual assistants. These things are eventually going to, in some way, become evidence.
Now, I think it would be very interesting to see this happen and then have a real savvy defense attorney try and present the AI the same as you would someone that's that you're in an intimate relationship with, a spouse, a significant other, whatever. And there's the whole premise that what you say in the privacy of your bedroom to that person stays private, and they cannot be compelled in court to divulge those conversations. So an AI in this case would be akin to an intimate partner philosophically. So could you claim that same protection?
Miss Siri, have you or have you ever been or are you now the virtual assistant of Brian Chafin?
Hold on. Let me look that up for you.
So let me try to get this a little back on the rails. Barring Apple's, you know, programming a Siri to somehow be capable to be interrogated, what we're kind of skirting around the bush about are the two different types of ways that the privacy can be maintained here with AI. So the one that we've been talking about is basically learn and purge. The way that neural nets work is, rather than having programmers try and figure out the infinite number of if-then statements that they would have to program to get something that appears to be kind of rational, like a human being is in making decisions. They use this neural net software that kind of catches patterns over time and builds those patterns. And the way that they teach the neural nets is they feed it a ton of data. One good example of this is the way that self-driving cars by Google and by Tesla have been programmed. They pump tons of video of roads in there. And the videos would be, I don't know, tens and tens of bazillions of terabytes of data when they're stored, and they run this video through the AI to let it learn about, oh, it's good to, you know, stay within the lines of the road. When the lines have dashes, it means something. And over time, the neural nets pick up on these patterns and learn from them. Now, each Tesla car does not come with, you know, a huge server in the back storing all this video. It makes no sense. They just have the result of that processing of those neural nets, kind of a resulting little mini brain, that when it gets new video that it's capturing through its cameras of the roads that are being driven on, it kind of knows what to do. It doesn't even necessarily know why it knows what it does, because it's gotten through so many transactions of video that it's processed, but it does the right thing generally.
Processed and purged.
Right, but the backing data is not there, and it can be purged, and it's gone, and there's nothing actionable about it. So that's one thing. The weakness of that, I think you guys rightly kind of vetted out, is that maybe someday someone will program some interface where you can interrogate the system, and then it becomes kind of a question of, is this information any more provable or actionable than any other human being that's providing hearsay? We'll leave that for some science fiction show to deal with. The other part technology that helps here is something that's there's two sub technologies there, but it's kind of broadly considered to be actionable cryptography. The kind of the cryptography that we're used to on the iPhone and whatnot are, hey, all our data, we know what it looks like. It's a photo of a puppy wearing a hat or whatever is on our phone. And when it's encrypted, it just is all scrambled. Nobody can make use of it. Once you use a decryption key, you get to see the results that come out of it. And you can't really do anything. Like, you can't change the normally you could take that photo, put it into Photoshop once it's decrypted, and change the color of the hat from purple to green or whatever you want to do. But until you decrypt it, you can't do anything with that data, because if you mess it with it, even like one byte out of place, you'll never decrypt it again. It'll just come out as garbage. It becomes unrecoverable once it's kind of messed with. So that's normal cryptography, and it's kind of fragile in that state, that once you change any bit of it, it's probably unrecoverable. Actionable cryptography does kind of two things. One, it lets you work with the data without ever knowing what the data is to do things, some of which is what it is called. Fully homomorphic encryption. And those allow for calculations to be made of the underlying data. So you could think about this if you had people managing your money in wanting to kind of do the right things in investment without necessarily having access to the underlying accounts and still be able to do processes of it, or without knowing who the ultimate owners are of those accounts in the financial world, you can do these actions and never see what is the underlying data that's beneath the encryption, yet you could still act on it. And that's really a bunch of complex math that goes
over. Yeah, that sounds like magic, man.
But it exists. It's been out for IBM. I believe an intern at IBM developed it about 7 or 8 years ago, and that state of the art has advanced a bit. And then there's another area of encrypted searchable data. And it's like it sounds. Even though you can't actually see the data itself, you can still search and act on it. So I don't know if that necessarily is a panacea for what Apple wants to do, but those are really good tools. And what they could help with is kind of when this consciousness or this artificial intelligence is taught, And if even the temporary data that it's getting is somewhat encrypted in this way, you know, the results become very unclear as to why this artificial intelligence agent knows that you, you know, prefer cartoons to, you know, dramas or comedies to action movies and things of that nature. It becomes even more opaque and more difficult to get at any of the underlying data. So even if Apple has to have a little bit of cache of information as it's teaching your AI, maybe a week's worth, it could be encrypted in this format. Really, the only thing, and no one will ever be able to see the underlying data. There will never be evidence of it that can be decrypted. And yet the artificial intelligence agent will be the recipient of that learning with it. So that helps harden the whole process a bit. They're always, you know, it's just kind of common in life, and I think Steve Jobs alluded to it a long time ago when people first started jailbreaking the iPhone, which is there will always be a cat and mouse game with people providing really good security and breaking really good security. And there's no doubt, I'm sure there'll be some weaknesses in approaches of purging kind of this information while you're training and or using this kind of actionable cryptography to train things. But the bottom line is you need to find a balance in life where it's not too onerous and provides, you know, good enough security. And I think Apple's always done a pretty good job of that in the past. It's not perfect. Things can be broken. And the point is that this kind of tech with regard to making AI better could allow Apple to continue to maintain such a balance. Will it be perfect? Maybe can someone make some interrogatable thing that gives out some questionable hints of what may or may not happen? Maybe. But I think you'll find it's a lot better than a lot of the other options and probably does a pretty reasonable job of maintaining a lot of security for people while still really knowing and getting you, which is, I think, the thing that we like about a lot of these other services like Amazon Echo and whatnot.
Give us an example of the first. You gave us an example of where the second method has been deployed at IBM. The fact that an intern developed it.
I hope that intern got a job.
Yeah, I think that he got like some patents out of it for the company, and has gone on to do pretty well. One of the examples are, it's kind of like a blindfolded calculator. If you want your accountant to do your taxes, right, but not know how much money you actually have, you can act on your encrypted data, this homomorphic encryption. It can encrypt all your data with all the values that came in about your taxes and whatnot. The accountant can then process it, because taxes are kind of done in a known way. It's the total of whatever your salary plus your capital gains or whatever it was. The actual numbers are kind of irrelevant, say, generally speaking, and you plop those things in. The accountant never actually needs to see those, yet the calculations at the end would be done right, and maybe they would be revealed. Well, obviously, it would be revealed to the IRS at the end. But you could hide a lot of your sensitive financial information that way, and yet still have people work on it and not know and be confident that the calculations are correct and not know what the underlying values are really are. So those were some of the things that early on that I believe they were working on at IBM. I don't know what they've done since. I haven't kept up on the details on it, but that's one type of thing on it that's been used on the homomorphic encryption.
So so my understanding of machine learning and artificial intelligence in general is that even when corporations are developing it, that a lot of it ends up sort of white papered and either available to the public or exposed to the public. Is that your understanding too?
You mean the underlying tech for like
machine
learning algorithms?
Yeah, the research that goes into this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what the total research is. Elon Musk has, I believe, a company doing AI and a bunch of other companies in the Valley that are kind of still semi under the surface are doing their thing. And I suspect a lot of their early work is is proprietary and they may open it up. But what has made AI get a lot better over the recent, I don't know, 5 years or so is exactly what you're saying. A lot of it has been open source and a lot of it has come from universities and people have been updating it in Git and GitHub and whatnot. Yeah, sorry, I'm in New York, so if you guys hear a siren, that's why.
True. We'll deal with it.
They're coming for the puppies and hat. Anyway, so I agree with you that I think a lot of it has been open source, but I'm sure there's a ton of proprietary stuff out there as well. And
I remember reading a piece, and it's hard to know if this was just a hit piece or something with a spot of truth to it, and that's that Apple has been held back because while it will attend conferences, it doesn't present to conferences, and it doesn't release any of its research in the form of white papers or share what it's doing in these areas, and that makes the rest of the artificial intelligence and machine learning community a little tense, and it's also made it even harder for Apple to recruit people because they like the culture as it is.
Yeah.
I don't really know if that's true. Here's why I ask. Who owns this stuff that's been done in this first method of yours? I call it yours because you introduced it to us.
You mean the underlying data, like the tax information that's been encrypted and processed?
No. Who's doing that work, and therefore who's doing the research on making that stuff?
So the technology specifically?
The technology. That's what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, it started at IBM. I believe that a bunch of other universities have gone on to do some work. And I believe actually the encrypted searchable data, I know that Microsoft's working on some of that, and a bunch of other players are using that, which is kind of an offshoot of this homomorphic encryption. And so it's spread. Like once it was known, others are doing it. You know, who owns the... Obviously, who owns the original patent is probably IBM at this point, but I think people have spread on it. Whether or not there's kind of a de facto go-to set of AI libraries that use this, I really don't know enough about the field.
So it's actually possible that Apple is working in this sort of area already. It's conceivable.
Yeah, you know, I think part of what you said is a legit concern in that there is a certain type of person that will put some ideology over everything and not go because, oh, Apple may keep this closed. I think that's a bunch of noise just because the Valley likes to create noise. The bottom line is if Apple were doing something super awesome and interesting in AI and you were an AI person, you'd want to be involved because Apple in the past has open sourced a whole bunch of stuff. Maybe they will, right? All this notion, like from the first moment I have an itch in my head about a thought, it needs to be open source, this silliness, because it's just not the way the Valley works. A lot of the stuff that ends up being open source originally was in people's brains and proprietary, and they worked it out to the point where they got it and were in a happy place and then end up sharing it. Apple may do so, Apple might not do so, but the reality is most of the people in Silicon Valley are kind of go-getters with regard to what their interests are. And if someone's doing something awesome and great, you're going to go there because you want to be part of what they're doing. So if people aren't going to Apple, I doubt it's got anything to do with their open source policy on this tech or not, as much as it, maybe they're just not doing anything terribly interesting.
Yeah, fair enough. And that was a bit of a rabbit hole in the first place. But so I have another angle on this, and that is how... losing my train of thought. You and I differ, John.
No way.
Yes. One of the areas that you and I differ is...
hairstyles.
Yes. Is actually, we're almost polar opposites. We're almost diametrically opposed when it comes to
hair. Pretty much.
Although I'm headed more in your direction than I really want to admit. But John is shaved. And
this has gone wrong already on so many levels.
So
anyway,
here's what I'm trying to ask you. so you and I differ on the subject of one Tim Cook, CEO of Apple. I believe he is an excellent speaker, and I think that you are blind because you think that he is not an excellent speaker.
And John, how do you feel?
Human Ambien, I believe I heard someone say, and it couldn't have been better put.
Yeah, I think that was you.
Lovely human being, but not a dynamic.
Well, this is the reason why I say that when I say that he's a good speaker and that you're blind for not seeing it, it's because it's all about the body English. When you watch
his robotic automaton.
No, dude, you're just extremely excited. Blind to the details, man. You see what you want and then you move on, and with a string of invectives trailing in your wake.
Most boring presentations.
All right, so be that as it may, one of the things that he has said is that, and I believe the example was specifically, Apple News doesn't need to know what song you're listening to. And he's talking about basically that this notion of apps sharing data between them is antithetical to privacy, and that Apple believes very strongly that you shouldn't be sharing that information between apps. You shouldn't, which is one of the things that I've been saying is holding Apple back on the AI front. And my question is, does this, what do you call it? Homomorphic? Got to tell me one more time.
Encryption. That's right.
Homomorphic encryption. Is that not still at odds with that notion that one app shouldn't know what another app is, what you're doing in another app?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is it completely enables that, right, with a level of privacy that wasn't available before. So you would use the technology in some sense as a really private pipe to keep the information private and yet still make it actionable and shareable. Of course, Tim Cook, I don't even want to hold his feet to the fire for that stupid moronic statement that he made, because it's one of marketing that was made many times, not just by him, but by Steve Jobs, the proverbial one being, we don't need an iPod that plays video, and next year he has an iPod that plays video, and then quote-unquote, because we figured out how to do it right, end quote, right? It's always their excuse for marketing. So, to some extent, I'm going to write it off as that. Maybe it's a profoundly misguided ideology that he has. I don't know. It's silly. Clearly, a bunch of their apps share information. Contacts is totally exploited and used by mail and all those applications.
Well, third-party apps, too.
Yeah, and photos and all kinds of stuff. It's silliness to say that applications shouldn't communicate with themselves. Either it was taken out of context, or it's just a silly, again, marketing fluff statement that I'm just going to blow off as irrelevant nonsense. Of course, applications should use information from one another. And it's a question of how useful is that shared information to people? Now, sometimes knowing about a song in one app is kind of dumb and meaningless. I don't know why my accounting software needs to know what iTunes song I'm playing.
But I can tell you why Apple News needs to know what I listen to.
Sure, you get good news about the band that you're interested in. This is simple stuff. And I agree with you. It's you had a lot of good examples through your articles mentioning about the kinds of synergies you could have in sharing the information and how it would totally enrich your life. This is self-evident. The reason I refuse to even criticize Tim Cook on it is he's not that profoundly stupid a human being. This is just market expedience, or it was in context of some other conversation that we didn't have the full context to. I just don't believe he's that dumb.
Yeah, it could be obfuscation and misdirection. He was very specifically talking. This was one of his interviews where he was talking about the value of privacy and the fact that privacy will become more of a marketing point as time marches on.
So, yeah, I mean, this kind of thing has been happening in the industry for forever. I mean, I just remember Tim Cook in some ways is not above making such mistakes. But I'm also going to write this following part off as marketing obfuscation, which is he says, you don't want to have a combination laptop and tablet because it's a combo toaster and refrigerator. First of all, a company that makes iTunes and makes you sync your photo library through iTunes to your iPhone. Talk about a toaster combined with a freaking refrigerator. he should not be throwing any bricks through his glass house. I mean, I can't think of too many more brain damage combinations of stuff that you have to do than through iTunes that they're already doing than to criticize this.
Yeah, but iTunes is software. iTunes is not a piece of hardware, and Tim was very specifically talking about hardware.
Well, and with regard to that, he's also wrong. It's absolutely 100% clear that at the very least, laptops are going to converge into these tablet and laptop kind of combinations. You only need to look at the iPad market to see how many keyboards look like clamshell laptops. They're trying to make this thing like a laptop. And Apple is just slow, stubborn, or stupid in adding mouse support to the iPad to get it to be a combination device. The hardware that's been done on the Windows side of things is actually really good. The Surface Book is the hardware part is done really well. And, you know, it brings to mind this false dichotomy. Steve Jobs is famous for saying, you don't want to sit at your desktop machine and stick your hand out all day moving Windows and stuff around on the user interface and use it through a touch interface. What a moronic false dichotomy that is. As if that's the only way you should use it. How about I still use my mouse or trackpad most of the time, and every once in a while when it makes total sense for me to reach my hand out and do something on a touchscreen, I'll do it because I have the option. And it's the same. Having that mixed-use UI is totally doable on a laptop and even more natural in that, hey, if I want to rip the screen off the keypad and use it just to passively consume data, it's a great experience. And then later when I need to build a complex keynote presentation or a long article or a book, I'll snap that back in and then use the trackpad and mouse, and you can have the best of all worlds. It's to me as obvious as when people were making the moronic argument that people don't want a convergence device. They want a separate MP3 player and they want a separate phone, and those two should never be combined and no one will ever do it. And then it was just a question of getting the recipe right. And that's really hard. I don't want to diminish that. And while Microsoft might have gotten the recipe right on the Surface Book on the hardware side, the UI is still horror and unpleasant to work with, for me at least. But
isn't that the key to the toaster fridge nonsense in the first place?
Well, my point is he's wrong about that. That's going to happen.
So what you're saying is that it ceases to be a toaster fridge when you get the interface correct.
That's right. Just like a dumb convergence device becomes a brilliant convergence device when you get the combo right. All the combo MP3 players and phones before the iPhone were terrible. And that's why people were saying they shouldn't be converged and they shall always remain separate because the few trials that were attempted were bad. But what was proven by that is once you get the recipe right, all that goes away. And now it's hard to believe that anyone was ever arguing for separate devices. It's kind of a silly position now. And it will be the exact same thing with the laptops and the tablets. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when and how that UI is going to be surmounted. Anyway, we've gotten a little bit off track in that. I believe that statement by Tim was also another baloney statement of we're not ready in the market to make this, so in the meantime, we're going to disparage everybody else's stuff, even though we do the same kind of toaster oven combinations in our software and hardware.
It could be that. I will grant you, and I give great merit to most of the arguments you just made. I'm not actually sure that I want to reach out and touch my iMac screen, but that's just me. But Tim doesn't do the same brand of misdirection. So Steve infamously and famously and brilliantly did the, well, we're not going to do this. And then 9 months later, they do it. And you know, eventually we kind of figured out that that's what he was doing. Tim has never done that. Tim has actually instead always telegraphed what Apple is going to do, but encoded messages that have to be parsed pretty closely to understand, to wit. And I'm going to go ahead and bring this up because I love patting myself on the back for it. It was Tim who told us that Apple would compete with netbooks with an iPod Supertouch, is what I called it at the time. And it was, I think, a year and a half later that Apple introduced the iPad, which was designed to compete with netbooks. And netbooks are now done. Mm-hmm. Tablets are a thing. That's actually how Tim works. Tim is almost like the mirror. He's like the mirror version from Star Trek of Steve when it comes to his coded messages for the future.
Well, so I'm not going to argue on fine points about Tim Cook's behavior, because frankly, I pass out and hit the desk before I care, and you clearly do. So you're more of an expert on it than I am. And then I'll just say, well, he's simply wrong. And that doesn't make him a bad person or any less of a leader, because Steve Jobs was also wrong. You know, he was big on the DV videos front when the world was passing him by with ripping CDs, and he was completely wrong on that. And to his credit, he later came back and said, I was wrong, I missed it, and fixed it. So, you know, Apple, Tim Cook is not above missing the boat there. But my point is, it really doesn't even matter whether we're right or wrong. It's probably a good conversation to have elsewhere, where I will show you that, of course, I'm right. But it doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong on this topic, even though I'm right. The point, though, is that if it's not misdirection, then it's simply just not having.
Well, to your point, the iPad Pro has an available keyboard option from Apple, along with the stylus option from Apple. To your point.
Right. And so, and before they said they never have a stylus because the finger was all you ever needed, right? And apparently that's not the case. Apparently a stylus
is... Don't even get me started on that one.
Apple even sold styluses in the stores for a while.
Until they stopped. Oh, that drives me nuts. You have 10 of them, and if you want to do finger paintings, you got 10 of them on the Indy fans.
But it just goes to show that eventually you find out nice ways to integrate these things in multiple ways. And maybe it was necessary to go through this period of denial of anything else to really focus and get the UI done well for most of the use, and having this accessory device so it wasn't dependent upon it. Maybe that was a good thing as well.
Now, I think it was a good thing because Apple was focused on making an interface where they didn't have the crutch, so to speak, of a stylus to fall back on. So they had to make an interface that worked really well without any accessories. And then once that was done, then they took what everyone else had already been doing in the stylus space, figured out what worked well and what didn't, and how to make a really good stylus, and then came out with that. But you don't need an Apple Pencil to use an iPad.
Yeah, and that actually is the important aspect, in my opinion, of Apple's philosophy on styli. It just, again, puts me on super mega mad, mega brain and hemorrhaging inducing tilt. This notion that that we don't need styluses because we have them on the end of it. If you're going to be Miro, that's fine. If you want to be any other kind of artist, though, you maybe need something like a pencil or a pen or a stylus. All right. Anyway.
So Brian, when you're creating your art.
I might as well be doing finger paintings. I'm a terrible artist and you know it. So listen, what does Vocal IQ have to do with this?
All right. So first off, we should probably tell people what Vocal IQ is.
Yeah, tell me what Vocal IQ is, because I honestly haven't. Either I haven't had time or I haven't bothered to read your articles on the subject. So I'm going to be the stand-in for our listeners, and please tell me what exactly Vocal IQ is.
Well, first off, John, I like you now.
Thanks. I think you're great, Jeff.
It's the puppies wearing hats, isn't it?
Yep. Yep, yeah. It totally is. Okay. Sorry. So Vocal IQ is a company that's been working on the kind of AI voice command recognition technology stuff. So in a manner of speaking, it would be like Siri. It would be like Alexa from Amazon and Cortana from Microsoft. But this is like way beyond what these other systems are, and it's a lot more intelligent, and it's been able to learn without needing nearly as much input. So if you look at what Apple's getting for Siri, I mean, they're getting like millions of queries a day, and they're improving Siri based on those millions of queries. What Vocal IQ did was they hired, I think it was like 1,000 people, 100 people. I don't know. It was, in the grand scheme of things, it was a small number of people, and had them feeding queries into Vocal IQ. And so when they're done, they have like 10,000 to 50,000 something, 100,000 queries that they've been able to parse through. And the way that Vocal IQ is able to respond is far better and far more accurate than any of the other systems that are currently out there. And, you know, and so that's with a small data set. And if you have a bigger data set, well, then, you know, who knows just how far this can go. But so Apple came in and bought them last October, I think it was. So late-ish 2015, they picked up Vocal IQ before any other products came to market. And one of the things that Vocal IQ was working on was the ability to hit what I consider the Star Trek gold standard, but go beyond that, meaning you can just talk to the computer and it can talk back. And so they created this system where I could say something like, Siri, I need to go meet John for lunch, but I need to stop at the grocery store first, and then have the system parse through all that and get the course laid out for me, so I get directions first to the grocery store on the way to John's for in time for lunch. And let's say I take off and I'm heading out, and then I say, actually, you know what? I only need to go to the drugstore. And it understands context like a person would. So then it could dump the route for the or to the grocery store and route me over to Walgreens instead. And then John calls and says, instead of meeting at my place, I know this really great bookstore we can hang out where they have the awesome Puppies in Hats books. And so then I could say, all right, Siri, don't need to go to John's house. Get me over to this Puppies in Hats bookstore instead. And I haven't had to change anything that I would have otherwise input in. Like, I don't have to start and stop over. Or, wow, stop and start over. There so we go.
Sure be nice if... I guess the point being, and the thing that I did actually skim your second article at least, is that if Apple can understand what we're saying better, Siri can give us more useful information and useful features.
Yes. And so they bought the company, and instead of just funneling everything out that they wanted and calling it good, they let the Vocal IQ people stay in London, where the business is, and had them start working on figuring out how to integrate the Vocal IQ technology into Siri.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's what Apple does.
Right. Well, I mean, they could have just taken the people, absorbed them directly into Apple, and said, now you're on these teams. But they left them as an intact team.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the big things we get from Vocal IQ are better learning with less information, the ability to understand context, and the ability to respond to us in natural language when we're talking to it in natural language. And then it also has the ability to filter out background noise, including other conversations that systems like Siri and Alexa just simply can't work through. Part of what they were doing was pitching this to automakers, because then you could have an in-car system where it was all voice command and voice response. And the idea was you never need to look at a screen or touch a screen to interact with the interface.
Okay. All right. Wouldn't it be nice if, first of all, do we have any evidence that we've seen any of Vocal IQ's technology actually make its way into Siri in the wild yet?
I don't know.
I would say no.
Yeah, and I'm guessing no, but I don't have any evidence to say that Vocal IQ technology hasn't made it in yet. Now, keep in mind, though, we're talking about getting picked up last October.
Yeah, it's still early.
Right. So we could conceivably see something related to this at least demonstrated at Developers Conference in this month. It's June.
It's June, yeah.
Yeah, so like in 2 weeks.
In two, well, huh.
I'm praying they open up Siri up. It's kind of a catastrophe and an embarrassment that they've left it closed for so long.
It's true. But wouldn't it be really nice if Apple could actually marry Vocal IQ's technology to homomorphic encryption? Wouldn't that be nice? Because I don't want to lose sight of the fact that Siri needs to know about us to give us useful information. Google Now kicks Proactive's butt. Google Now on Android kicks Proactive's butt. But here's something, by the way. So I've set up reminders for birthdays. And I goofed up. My little sister, bless her, I'm so mad at myself. I had a reminder set up for the day before her birthday and was watching, waiting for it to come. And I thought I had reminders the day of for all of my birthdays, which I went in and laboriously set up by hand, which is kind of ridiculous that needs to be done, but I'm getting to that. And it turns out I didn't have one set up for her that day. And then since I didn't have a reminder pop up that day, I didn't actually think about it because I know that I've got reminders set up on the day of for everyone. Does that make any sense? It's like just the way my brain works. I ended up missing my little sister's birthday and it really frustrates me. Now, I was talking to a buddy of mine who is a big Google Now user, and Google Now tells him about birthdays of his friends from their Google Plus profile, from his contacts database, from, of course, all the email that the Google rifles through. And Google Now proactively lets him know when it's somebody's birthday without him ever having to do anything. Ever having had to do anything. He didn't have to set it up. Google Now is taking this information. Google Now knows that this is something we want to know, and it proactively offers it to you like a good virtual assistant should. Why doesn't that information pop up in Proactive on iOS? Why doesn't it pop up on my Mac? Why did I have to go in and set that stuff up by hand? And because I made why is it that Apple isn't putting this information to use for us? Google does it. Why can't Apple?
Well, it's going back to my older theme that Apple can't scale. It's a total failure of scale, and they're off focusing on whatever the new shiny thing is and ignoring everything else. Why is it that they bought the company that made Siri? They had those people there, and they didn't create an environment where those people could continue on working. Hopefully, that's what they fixed with the Vocal IQ people by letting that team stay together. But let that team continue to work on Siri. And those people just left as soon as they could. They left Apple, went out, built Viv, and brought it to the next level.
Viv is a competing AI that's just recently been shown off for the first time.
So, you know, and the reason is that the company only knows how to deal with a small team of A players and focus all the wood behind that arrowhead. And then all the other stuff that's going on in the company just seems to fall off a cliff and get ignored. My understanding is from various birdies that told me there's basically like one guy working on iTunes right now because the entire team was taken over and to focus on the disaster that is Apple Music to me. And you know, it's constantly like this. There's so many people that are hired, but Tim Cook has not figured out a way to say, look, it's okay if we're good at having one A team that figures out our new pioneering breakthrough thing, but we need B teams left to continue to advance the art. It shouldn't be a big deal for, and life should go on without the A team being there to increase our hard drive size from 1 terabyte to 2, to have a couple of more, you know, gigahertz or sub gigahertz speed in a laptop. For these changes, there needs to be a way for the company to go on and not halt. But what seems to happen is it's like they behave almost like a toddler playing with only its new toy and everything else is ignored. And you can't run a giant company that way and constantly do that. So that's my explanation for why. So I mean, you guys may have
it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea. Apple, Steve built Apple's culture around the idea of only having A players. And you're positing that Apple has basically reached the size where it needs B players to maintain the things that that there aren't enough A players to actually deal with. And that could be a great point, John.
That's one scenario. But even if they hired only A players, Apple is only able to pay attention, seemingly consciously, to a very small subgroup of those A players, and the rest are just kind of left out in the wilderness, not doing anything. They either don't have the authority or the structure to let them continue to work out in parallel, because the company can only focus consciously on one thing at a time. And that's got to change. Whether it's B players running those things or A players, I don't know. To me, it seems like, you know, Apple is getting to the point where they need to do things like the Vocal IQ bit, where they acquire it and let that company continue to exist. Because one, those CEOs, when they get acquired, you know, they're staying to the absolute limit. If they're Borged into Apple, they don't want to just be another VP that doesn't have the power to, you know, create their world and run it like they were when they're CEO. So they're out of there as soon as possible. And that, I think, explains a large bit of what happened with the Siri team. And if you Borg them and just let them be their own entity and continue to work, in some way, I think they've left FileMaker alone for whatever, and they're doing their thing, right? They get to do that because they're their own little entity. If they did that a little bit more with some of the tech, then maybe things can go on in parallel.
But that's antithetical to the formula Apple used to build itself.
Well, you know what else is antithetical? Is not putting out products. And they haven't updated their screen in forever. They haven't updated their desktops in forever. They haven't updated their laptops in an embarrassing long amount of time. So that also is antithetical. So which is the lesser of the antithetical positions that they're going to take?
Is it time for Apple to think differently about awesomeness? That's an interesting idea, John.
I don't know if it's time for them to think differently about awesomeness as far as their products go.
I'm just being hyperbolic.
Okay. But it is time for them to start thinking differently about staffing. I think they're still trying to run under Steve Jobs' philosophy of treat it like a startup all the time.
Well, no, they're not. They're not. We're not. That's not a thought. That's a stated goal. That's kind of what Apple University is all about.
And right. And, well, and they need to change that.
The brilliant thing about Steve is that he's absolutely committed to whatever policy and path he's taking until he chooses a new one. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, Steve Jobs, and this is something that that John's commented on before, but Steve Jobs will be absolutely right until he decides that something new is right, and then screw the old thing and he's off to do a new thing. So,
and he's still absolutely right.
If he saw he's absolutely right again. Mm-hmm. But if he saw that Apple was having a scaling problem because of his run lean like a startup idea, he'd find a way to change it.
He kind of did early on in the following way. I don't know if it wasn't by design. It was somewhat reactionary. But, and it certainly was not the healthiest of ways. But he did have a B team process. And it was basically Woz and the Apple II, right? He didn't care a dang about it. It was making money, keeping the company afloat. And so he was all right with it.
No, but he wasn't all right with it. He wanted it gone. He thought it was an embarrassment.
Well, that part it was part of his, you know, youth. But he took the money. Bottom line is, he took the money. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, that worked. You had someone there that still cared enough, whether they were the B team or not, to keep making money. And it let him take his little band of merry men, what he viewed as the A team, to develop the new thing. And that's a perfectly reasonable construct, where you leave these B teams, or whatever you want to call them, out to keep making money. Well, and Apple can still operate like a startup in the sense that they put all the wood behind whatever arrow that they're going for the band of merry men for their next new thing. But you can't just let all these other plates drop when those plates are making tons of money.
But I think, first of all, I would never call Woz a B-teamer. The people working on Apple II may have been some B-teamers, but Woz himself was never a B-teamer.
They were the alternate A-team.
I'm not going to,
but
focus on being PC here or not. It's not a new revelation that Steve may have treated that entire division that way.
Yes, he did.
Oh, yes,
but I would,
and he and I would quibble with the notion
that he was content to let that division make the money because he actually wanted to make the Apple II go away entirely.
So, and it comes full circle
prematurely, I might add.
Yeah, but he definitely treated that division that way. Woz was the head of that division, and you're saying that he may have been wrong for that thing, for some of his calls there, which gets a roundabout circle to me saying, and if Steve can be wrong, sure as heck, Tim Cook can be wrong too.
That's true. It's absolutely true. Now, here's a fun thing, Jeff. The script has scrolled off. I hate Skype sometimes.
Well,
and it's not like I just haven't said it enough to have it memorized yet.
That's okay, because here's half of a script. So do you want to try run through with this?
Yeah, let's go ahead and try a run through with this. By the way, John, we've come to the end of our time here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yep,
thank you guys for having me. That was a great, if not messy, discussion.
It was
a fun roller coaster ride.
And after this, I'll be in my bunk with some puppies wearing hats.
I'm going to cue the music. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, including puppies and hats, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom. Recorded just for TMO, and that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer, unless I found a new source for some puppies wearing hats. Oh my.
That really is a sight.